Hi, welcome to A Time to Thrill. It's me, your host, Amy Austin. It is February, and I have the best interview for you. So today I'm interviewing author Sharon Hamilton. She's another author who has written over 100 novels, mostly romance, a little bit of paranormal, but it's an interesting conversation. Of course, I haven't seen Sharon in a few years. She used to live in California, and I used to see her at various writing events. But during the pandemic, she finally settled in Florida, and I don't think she's been back in a while. But before we get to the interview, I do want to talk to you about what's going on. First, I have a new short story available for newsletter subscribers. It is called False Positive. I will include a link to get the story in the show notes, but if you're a subscriber of the Amy Austin newsletter, then you should have received a notice about it. And if you didn't get it, check your spam, promotions folder, whatever that is, whitelist me, and you'll be sure to get all further emails from me. Also, coming out just a little over a month from now, March 8th, is Without Consent. It's the third book in the Nicole Long legal thriller series, a spinoff of the Casey Court legal thriller series. I really like this book. It's very murder and mayhem. I'll just say that. A lot of murder, a lot of mayhem. It's not violent. Well, not too violent. Actually, I don't think there's any violence on the page. I hope. No, there isn't any. But a lot happens. The stakes are pretty high for Nicole, for Laurie Pope, and there are a couple of new characters I've introduced that I really like, and I think you'll like too. Lauren Logan and Blake Harden Tatum. Lauren's a police detective who has just recently been assigned to homicide, and Blake Harden Tatum, unfortunately, was laid off from an ink, paper, a newspaper, the Plain Dealer, and she's having to go it alone. So she's doing the thing a lot of former reporters did, starting both a blog and a podcast. But back in the early podcasting days, not now when there's a glut and everyone, including me, has a podcast. So it's a pretty interesting story. It has an interesting twist of an ending. And of course, it leads into the next book, which I'm writing now, that features Blake and Logan as well as Nicole Long. So they'll be ongoing. You might want to pay attention to the details because they will crop up again later. So those are the main two things I want to talk about, False Positive and Without Consent. First is free, short story. Actually, features both Nicole Long and Casey Court. It's pretty interesting. As well as Casey's neighbors, Greg and Jason. Haven't seen them in a while. It was good to peek in on them. And that's what's, I think that's all that's going on. It's February. I don't have COVID, for which I'm grateful. I got to spend some time with some writers at the end of January at a retreat. We're back to beach retreats. It's been 4 years. Okay, so that's pretty exciting. That's about it. I'm going to maybe travel in March. I haven't decided. I don't know. Long flights are getting harder as I get older. And I'm thinking of going to Australia. So that's not close to actually anything except maybe Indonesia. And other than that, it's just writing and plugging away. And I look forward to hearing from you about what you think about the podcast, what you think about Casey Court and Nicole Long. You can always email me. The information's on my website, amyaustin.com, as well as in the show notes. So without further ado, let's get to the interview with New York Times and USA Today bestselling author Sharon Hamilton. Hi, this is Amy Austin. Welcome to A Time to Thrill. I am delighted to have Sharon Hamilton as a guest this month. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, Amy. Nice to be here.
I know. I'm so excited. I have so many questions for you, but right now you have moved. Well, you know, I met all of you when we were all in California. You moved not because of the pandemic, but it feels like everybody has just fled the state.
We left because of you guys. No, I'm just kidding. No, yeah, we left. I started investing in Florida real estate about 4 years ago, and then just to see how we liked it, and and then we moved here full time almost 2 years ago. So,
oh, it's been 2 years. Wow. Because when I reached out to you, I was like, "Is she there permanent?" Because you were going back and forth for a while.
We were going back and forth just to get the California property ready to sell, and that took a lot longer than we had anticipated. You know, getting it ready for sale. It sold quick, but it.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a lot of work.
Okay. So, Sharon, I met you. Oh my God. I was actually thinking about this yesterday. I met you some years ago, but I have no good number on it. When you came down to Orange County to give a talk, do you remember for the OCC, for the Orange County RWA chapter?
That was probably 10 years ago.
Was it that long ago?
Yeah. Oh, or maybe 8 years ago. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I remember you came down and gave a talk, and that was 10 years ago. Sorry, 10 years ago. So you were at a completely different point in your career. But one of the things we talked about was interesting was the germination or your idea for writing seals. Because I don't want to say it's a niche. It's not even a subgenre. It is a niche, I guess, in romance. And I know a couple of people who write in it, but only a couple. There's probably 10 more I don't know. But what was it that inspired you to start with SEALs?
Well, our son was a Navy SEAL medic for 10 years, and I really never had anticipated writing military romantic suspense. I had always been a paranormal, sci-fi, fantasy reader as far as my reading delights. I wasn't sure I could really write one. So we noticed, you know, the transformation of our son from graduating high school, going straight into the Navy, you know, being one of 12 that graduated in his class that started with 192.
Wow.
In the BUDS training. And then, you know, we sent him off a boy and he came back a man. And that whole transformation really moved me in a lot of ways. And then I got to meet other people who he was associated with. And it just became something I was fascinated with and then really wanted to support. Because I felt that some of the stories that were out there were very flat, were not really defining or showing the character of the men and women who were involved and their families and, you know, how it affected their families. So I thought I could speak to that as a mother watching her son go through that, but also as a mother giving him to his wife and now having her worry about it, take the burden off of me. And as he became a father and, you know, his decisions to stay in or not. And so I'm very proud of him, but I'm proud of all those guys, even the ones that try out for BUDS or try out for the SEALs and don't make it. And he has a brother-in-law who didn't make it. So that was a whole family friction thing in his family that it left. You know, just the whole thing moved me greatly. So I was inspired to write.
So what is the three dimensionality that you're including? So is it more, how can I say this? Are you telling a bigger story? So including family and including more interrelationship of the hero?
Yes, I'd say it's very little about the war or the tactics. There are some writers that just do a killer job describing the firepower. Every, you know, they can describe how to take apart an AR-15 and put it back together again. I don't do that. I don't get that detailed. But I do get the lingo. I do get the way the family pictures and what some of the issues can be with the relationships. You got a guy going overseas with $1 million worth of training and equipment. He comes home and he has to do the laundry, clean the dishes, put the cat out, you know?
I've heard that transition is hard.
It is. And then after they get out too, that's another whole story of the ones that love their brotherhood, even though, you know, they've been close to dying many times, unfortunately have killed people. And then how do you live with that? How do you go on with the rest of your life? What do you tell your kids and your grandkids? Would you recommend that for your children? Some of them do, some of them don't. So there's a lot of issues there. You know, it's a different kind of a profession. I suppose somebody that was involved with the police or fire, EMT, first responders, you know, they would have that kind of thing too. And I just have it from this unique perspective, which is why I don't write about Marines, Air Force pilots, flame jumpers, all that stuff, which I could. It's the same guy, different equipment. Mm-hmm. I choose not to.
Do you think that this generation of people in the military, I want to say, talks more about it? Because I grew up with my grandfather, you know, was in World War II. Yeah. And actually nobody in my family was in Vietnam. They all had high draft numbers. But nobody talked about it? Like I mean, he's buried in like a military cemetery, but that between that and the fact that there's a picture my grandparents are dead. Mm-hmm. But there was a picture mm-hmm. of him in uniform in the house. There was mm-hmm. no conversation about it. Yes, I went to the war. Yes, I was in the army, and that was it. Like, you know, yeah. It was very limited, but I feel there's more discourse now around it.
Look at what's happened in our whole society. There's more discourse about everything. I mean, there's more discourse about how campaigns are run, campaign financing, running for president or whatever. The movers and shakers in Davos. I mean, we hear a lot more things about the world through social media than we ever did before. All that stuff still went on. We just never heard about it.
That's true. That's true.
And so I think it's just part of that whole scene where the public loves to find out things. They've always been curious about those things that nobody ever talked about. Just like the code talkers, you know, those mm-hmm. Navajo code talkers came back to Arizona and they were told never to discuss their military service. And it took until Obama was president before the first one even got a star, you mm-hmm. know, got a medal, because they never talked about it. They didn't talk about it with their families and it was almost lost. There were only like 10 of them alive when they finally started giving out medals. It's just a change in our society. And I think, unfortunately, some people talk too much.
There is that.
I don't think mine are just fictional stories. Mm-hmm. And I think that's all I want to do. I don't want to say that I'm 100% accurate because it's all made up in my head.
Right. Yes, I
I'm not divulging any national secrets.
For sure. So the other, many of the authors we know, you had an entire full life and career before you started writing romance. Yes. So what was it that made you take that shift? You can talk about it, but you had like a career in real estate, apparently mm-hmm. was doing quite, yes. It was doing very, very well. So what made you shift? Because for all of us, I guess it was a huge shift. Yeah. And I practiced law. It's not at all the same.
Yes. Yes. Well, we lost our house in a fire. This wasn't a California wildfire or anything. It was just a freak electrical issue. Our house burned down in 2008. And that was right at the time I was selling real estate. I was doing a lot of short sales, helping families get out of the house, negotiating real estate sales where the bank would take less. Unfortunately, right. They wouldn't allow the homeowner to pay the lower price, but an investor could come in and buy it. I didn't like that. I didn't want to work for banks. I got really, I saved a lot of people's credit. That was the best I could do for them. I couldn't get them any money, but I could save their credit. And I felt really strongly about that. I had an agent very early on. And I said, I think I could write stories about real estate foreclosure. And she goes, oh God, no, Sharon, don't. Nobody who's in foreclosure wants to read about foreclosure. And I said, oh, good point. So, but you write what you know. And so that whole part, I liked it because I did well. But it helped my kids go to college. It helped us take vacations and pay off loans and things like that. But when the house burned down, I just didn't have the drive to go out and buy brand new suits and everything. And I just thought, I need a career change. I want to do something creative, not with dollars and cents and not, bailing out people. So I'd always wanted to write. So I asked my husband and daughter, we were all business partners together. And I said, can I just take a few months off and see if I can write? I don't even know if I can finish a book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they said, oh, sure. Because they expected me to come back in about 3 or 4 months. And that was in 2009, and I've never been back since.
Wow. So let me say this. So I'm sure you're out in the world, and I've met many people who want to write a book, and it turns out the number of people who finish books is much smaller than that. Yeah. I know obviously a lot of them, so my view is a little weighted. But what was it? What do you think it was? What is the gumption, drive, determination that helped you finish that first book rather than tinkering around for, 20 years, with five words?
Well, I tinkered around with it plenty, but I wrote that first book. It wasn't very good. It was 90,000 words. I wrote it in 30 days.
Wow.
And I didn't know if that was unusual or not. So I had a sort of a coach who was a writer, sort of, and she said, oh my God, you did that in 30 days? And I said, yeah. Is that unusual? And she goes, well, nobody does that. I said, oh, really? Well, and then, I contested it. I found out it, didn't have a lot of things that it should have. Like, it didn't have a villain. Mm-hmm. It didn't have an arc. It didn't have all kinds of things. It was a mess. So I rewrote that story 57 times. Right?
Wow. I wrote my first book 8 times, and I thought that was a lot.
Yeah, 57 times. Now, you figure if you're going to write something 57 times and you don't hate it when you're done with your Franken book, then it ought to be okay. And it was a paranormal, so it turned out, it wasn't one of my huge bestsellers, but it's still one of my bestsellers overall. And I got it edited, I got it critiqued, I got it, I got it critiqued one way, and they said, oh, the villain has to wear red velvet and he's got to look like this, that. And then somebody else, I contested, and they said, I don't know if I can handle a gay villain. And I went, no, that's not what I meant. But, you overcompensate in one side and you go way over in the other side. Mm-hmm. And finally, somewhere in the middle is where you wind up with all your characters. And when I was happy with him, I could have worked on that book today, all these years until today, and to try to make it perfect. But at some point, you have to say, this book is done, and now I'm ready for another book.
Yes, that's a...
And so that's what happened. But I took a lot of courses. I was not afraid to get bashed. And I mean, I got bashed. I took so many courses that... I took them at the same time, like 4 and 5 writing courses, that I took one course about writing erotic scenes And it was at the same time I was taking a course on writing descriptive landscapes, and I posted the wrong thing to the wrong class, but almost booted from the one class. And so, you know, I just got very confused. I just jumped in and got bloody. I think that's, and the more I did that, the more I wholeheartedly embraced it and jumped in and got bloody, the better I liked it. This is like, okay, this is like dealing with foreclosures.
Mm-hmm. I know, trial by fire, I guess.
Exactly. So I figured, okay, if I don't care about this book, if I don't really like it, if I work on it until I like it, if I don't really like it, I'm not going to put it out there. Like Ernest Hemingway, he said he used to have his wife read his manuscripts, and if she got goosebumps, he'd figure they were okay. If she didn't, he would tear it up and write it again. I kind of feel that way. If I really am feeling for something, then the reader's going to feel it too. And that's where I get the inspiration.
So then, okay, so my next question is because getting in the trenches and writing the book is one thing. What gave you the gumption? Oh God, I've overused that word today, to publish it? Because it feels like there's two huge friction points with writers. One, sitting down and writing the book. And second is being willing to share that book with the public or with agents, with anybody, being willing to share and not sit in your room, you know, like a hobbit with just your book.
I once asked J.R. Ward about that, and I said, you put this book out there and you get all this advice from people, and how do you know whose advice to take? Because I'd just gone through this exercise where this one editor had said, well, you need to make him a total dresser, and then somebody else interpreted that he was gay. And it's like, how do you find out what's the right thing to do? And she looked at me and she said, well, that's the thing, isn't it? That's the whole ball game. That's what experience is going to teach you. You kind of have to guess. And then you're going to have to just use your gut to decide, okay, I'm going to do this and I'm going to ignore that. And then you see how that works. And if that doesn't work, then you go this and this and this. It is just not giving up and keep on going until you're happy, or happy for now, happily ever after, you know. Right. It's okay. It's good enough. It's good enough. It's never going to be perfect. And then, and listen and then decide, you know, okay, I hear one, two, oh, I've got, you know, I had somebody that critiqued me and said, oh, vampires would never do that. Well, these are fictional characters, my vampires too. You know, I mean, how do you know what vampires do? There's no fact in that.
Right.
But that's what people will tell you, you know. So you got to decide, okay, that's a valid argument. In my case, I said, no, I'm not going to listen to that. And that's what you learn by writing. Now it's almost 100 books.
Wow. And so what was the first book that you published?
The first book I published was Heavenly Lover. And it was that angel, guardian angel book that I redid 57 times. And I did a couple more. I did a vampire because I was a critique partner with a vampire writer at the time. I thought, well, if she can do it, I can do it. So I tried. I loved it. But, you know, they were okay. It was a good start. And then I thought about writing a seal romance, and that's what took off. And that's what made my name. So I've more or less stuck to the seals since then.
So I'll ask you this, because I don't think I've ever asked anybody this question, but were you surprised by the success?
I was, although I always thought I was a good writer. Mm-hmm. You know, my manager in real estate used to say, Sharon, don't write any notes to the secretaries up front, because I was known for writing a memo saying, correcting what they did or didn't do for me. And then they'd go home in tears. And the manager would come in and say, Sharon, you know, she quit today, or she, I had to go home and talk her into coming back. Would you quit writing memos? So I like to say everybody, to everybody, that now I get to write books that make people cry, but I get paid for it. So, so I think it's having a skill to cause an emotional reaction in the reader. And that's what you're going for. You want them to have an emotional reaction. You want them to not be able to put that thing down. You have to find out what's going on because you care about the characters, not the story. You care about the characters.
That's so interesting because I don't think, you know, Jen LeBlanc, I don't think I had really thought about the emotional reaction until she and I were talking about it one day. We were talking about why we read.
Uh-huh.
And we're, you know, and she was like, well, what do you, she was like, but what emotions are stirred up when you read? And I thought, oh, you're right. That's it. Which is one of the reasons I read, I'm into like police procedurals and some thrillers because I love that feeling of like comeuppance and justice. And for some reason that gets me going.
Sure.
But I hadn't thought about it. I was a kid who read and I wasn't, who knows when you're 7, 8, 9, 10, who's really deeply thinking about anything. But it was when Jen said that, I was like, it really made me think a lot more about it and actually read and consume reader emails in a different way because I could never quite understand what they were sharing.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're sharing parallel experiences or different things. And it was interesting to realize that the book had stirred up enough emotion in them that they were going to email me. And they wanted to share what it meant to them.
That's awesome. You know, a child, believe it or not, I firmly believe this. A child reads books to feel like an adult.
They
want to feel above their age limit, right? Mm-hmm. They don't want to feel below. They don't want to. But a 7 or 8 year old child wants to know what it's like and feels like. They want to imagine themselves being in high school, right? That's all the teachers I've talked to said they always read above their current age. Mm-hmm. And when high schoolers read about young marrieds and new marrieds, because that's where they're headed maybe eventually. So I think that's what you read to get out of your current state into something else. And the emotions are what takes you there.
Mm-hmm. That's so interesting. The more I write, I think the more I think about reading. But I was a consumer. I guess I've been a consumer of books far longer than I've been a writer of them.
Yeah.
So I still, it's like taking on a new identity that I've not fully yet stepped into. But as a consumer of books, I'm all there. So what kind of books did you grow up reading?
Oh, well, the obvious, you know, Nancy Drew, but I like the sci-fi, and then when I, science fiction, all kinds of that stuff. I don't even remember the names of the authors. I finally, in high school, started a little bit of romance, and then I got into Anne Rice, Young Married, and some vampire stuff, and some of her erotica. And I like to read books that had some sex in it because I like to read that, you know. Mm-hmm. So when I started writing, I would put that in because I like reading it. And I don't want it too much, but I like it in there. And I would look for it in the book. You know,
many of us did.
It's like the pretty part of the song, you know, that middle of the song is so pretty. You listen to the whole song and you just want that beautiful melody in the middle where they just, it just melts your heart. Mm-hmm. That's what I always listen for in a good song. It's the same thing with the book. You know, I want the feels. I want the feels.
No, I think we all do. So how, why science fiction? I mean, obviously I started reading the books that were in the house and then, you know, then you graduate to the library when they take you out of the house. But that was not,
well, we
were, read that, I guess.
Yeah, we were going to the moon. We were doing all that stuff when I was growing up, you know, I mean, and I think all the space race and the space stuff really fascinated me. And just the idea of going up in a little tin can and then having all this space out there and, you know, how dangerous that could be, that I thought that was really fascinating, and how things worked and what kinds of things would happen in a weightless situation. I just found that interesting. Plus, I like the idea of other worlds, other people, other species. And so it was not hard for me to get into the vampire thing too, or the guardian angels. And because I like the view of like how a guardian angel looks at humans. I like writing that, as well as how the vampires look at humans. So it's like another perspective on our human situation. And I like that.
That's fascinating. I mean, let me say this. I have had an interest in space. And I think in college, I took a class in astronomy. Yeah. And to be frank, it made my head hurt because I felt so small and insignificant, yes, in the scope of the universe that I was like, I need to opt out of this and go read some romance where I can be like the center. It was a lot. It's actually a topic I still don't like to talk about because it makes, yeah, you know, so I'm a human and I'm going to live my human life, and it feels very important. But when you look at the scope of even like humans, or the scope of agriculture and farming, or the scope of
Homo sapiens,
we're so small, and it's such a blip in time.
Yeah. We live our whole lives just like 10 feet into the surface. That's it. We have this big rock that we're living in, and we don't even see. We haven't even seen some of the ocean.
Exactly.
You know, the bottom of the ocean. So, yeah. It's fascinating. It just new frontiers, I guess. You know, I think that's exciting. I think that learning something. I also remember my mentor, my coach, when I sold real estate, because I used to coach realtors also. Mm-hmm. And he would say, you know, you have to pretend that on their forehead there are the letters MMFI, make me feel important. And you have to visualize that on their forehead when you're talking to them. They don't care about you, your plaques, your number one status, how much money you've made. They want to feel important. They want to feel that you are treating them like the most important person in the world. And I think when he used to tell me, and I learned a lot from this guy, believe it or not, I use it in my writing all the time. It's like if people learn from you, mm-hmm, they laugh and have a good time or have some kind of emotional reaction, make money. That's, of course, in real estate, it's make money. But learn from you, laugh, and it's profitable in some way, maybe emotionally profitable, we could say, not in real estate. If those three things occur, they will keep coming back over and over and over again. And that's true.
This is fascinating.
A good salesperson does that. They make you laugh. They make you feel unafraid of you're going to go out and do something you probably only do a few times in your life, spend a lot of money, mm-hmm, put your family at risk. And if you can do it laughing and learning, they'll come back. They'll trust you over and over again.
Oh my God, I wish. So my last job, I don't know if I ever told you this, my last job was in real estate. I actually worked for the California Association of Realtors. And I mean, as a lawyer, but what you're saying actually makes a lot of sense, because I think the thing that I disliked most about working with agents, mm-hmm, is that I felt like I was at the bottom of the list, because I never wanted to buy. This is me in California, because I bought real estate in many places, but in California, mm-hmm, I never wanted to buy the most expensive property I could. I always wanted to keep that mortgage down to, like, for me, 20% of my income. But that's my personal feeling. But there was always this encouragement of like, well, you should buy $2 million or $4 million, whatever it was. You know, and I never wanted to do that. But then what I ended up feeling was like, I was not going to be the first person to get a phone call back, even though I would tell people up front that I don't I don't want to drive around for 20 years. Basically, I would like to buy a house. I'd like to buy a house in a week, once in a month, or whatever that period is.
Yeah.
But it was never enough. And it was one of the things I actually disliked the least about buying real estate, and actually made me stop using agents, because I was like, I'm an adult. I can do this myself.
And you probably could. I mean, it's not rocket science. Let's face it. It's really not. I remember telling one client, she was all upset because her house hadn't sold, and she was kind of working with my daughter more than me. I had made the contact, and then my daughter had been working with her, and there had been a few mistakes, nothing really big, but she got all bent out of shape, and she was madder than what. And she had a whole house full of trophy heads that her father and grandfather had shot. Okay, there's these big, huge buffaloes and antelopes, and the whole house was covered in them. And if you know anything about people from California, people don't like trophy heads.
No, I think I've seen one.
Right. So it was all over the house. And I said to her, I looked at her, I said, my daughter is not your problem. Your problem is all those goddamn heads all around your house. And if you want to live there with these heads, your house is not going to sell. So it's up to you. You tell me what you want to do. Do you want to sell your house, or do you want to sleep with all these heads? And she goes, okay, can we get rid of the heads? And the husband looks at me and he goes, God, I've been telling her that for like 5 years now.
Oh my gosh.
You know, they'd gone through several agents, and they, you know, were all upset. And I just finally looked at her. I said, no. She started complaining. I said, no, none of that has anything to do with it. It's the trophy heads, because they can't get past it. They remember your house as being the one with all the dead animals in it. Mm-hmm. Come on. You know, they don't want to live in a house like that. You know, maybe you would, but I wouldn't. And she's like, oh. And then we laughed about it afterwards. I mean, they became some of our best, you know, one of our best clients. So, you know, this writing books is way easier than real estate. Trust me. Trust me. And but I get to, you know, it's a personality thing. I get to come up against all these things that make people do stuff and then solve the problem. And that's what you do in a book, right? That's what you do in a mystery, right?
Yeah.
What you do. You got to tell them what happens, right? You can't leave dangling parts.
As much as I'd like to, apparently I cannot do it.
Yeah. Or you have to say, oh, I'm sorry, I meant to, there's going to be a prequel if you forgot something, because I've done that too.
I may have had to do something like that today. I will just leave that alone.
I don't mean a prequel. I mean an epilogue. You know? Okay, well, there'll be an epilogue novella in about 3 months. Yeah, you know. But it's funny. It's funny, isn't it? It's so crazy what makes people do things. And that's what I find fascinating about writing. And, you know, you can sit in an airport, and you could look at people, and you can just make up all kinds of stories. Like my daughter and I, we were in the Czech Republic. We were traveling and we were sitting having dinner, and this couple across the way from us was having an argument. They were very proper though, but they're trying not to let anyone around them know that they were just seething with hatred for one another. And meanwhile, there's this violinist going around, this gypsy violinist, you know, serenading everybody. And they come over to their table, and the wife just gives him daggers, you know. My daughter and I are making up all these stories about what it could be, what's their issue, you know, and what they're saying to each other, you know. And she'd say, well, you didn't have to kiss that guy. Well, that guy's a better kisser than you are. You know, we thought about all these things they could be saying, and we had a hoot of a time just watching them. And that's the way people are. You know?
No, it's true. Like I do. I was just thinking, because I was in an airport like a couple of weeks ago, and I spent, we were sitting, you know, in the lounge in between, you know, whatever, and the layover. Yeah. And I like fascinatingly watch. I'm always wondering, like, well, where are they going? Are they here voluntarily? That relationship looks like it's not going to make it past their flight to LA.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yep. I saw a mother and son. I was traveling with my son, and I saw a mother and son pass us. And they were like us, but like 10 years later. And he had his head on his mom's shoulder. And I was like, oh, he still likes her. My son's like, I'll still like you when I'm 22 or whatever. But we were just, it's just fascinating to.
It is.
And I do wonder. And so I guess in a book, you do get to fulfill some of that. Like I get to.
Yes.
No, yes. I get to actually know more. I get to know more. Yes. I get to know what people think versus what people do. And in real life, I only get to know the do part and what people say.
Yes, thinking. Exactly. You're master of the universe. It's your story, right? I mean, where else in the world could you do that? You know, you certainly can't do it with your husband. You certainly can't do it with your family, right? I mean, you might dream about that. Oh my gosh, it'd be so great if I could just get them to do this, this, and this. But it's not going to happen. No. But in a story, you can do all that, right? And and make people cry and get paid for it.
Look, it does have its benefits, not going to lie. So what... So you have written, oh my God, so many books. I guess, would you say that you're a fast writer? I guess you would say
yes. I am. Yeah. Now I dictate, and I dictate on an air mattress in my pool.
And
so
how,
I take my cell phone and, you know, you can do, I love what, I think it's, what's his first name? It's Fox is the last name. But anyway, he dictates everything. Anyway, John Fox or George Fox or something. Anyway, he's a mystery writer, but he talks about dictating. And I use that and I use my cell phone and then I send it off. And it comes back about an hour or two later, all transcribed with lots of errors. And I go through and fix it, but it's way faster than trying to do it myself.
Can I ask you, does it, so one of the things people have said, especially, you know, when you're at the, you know, doctor and they're like, you know, about the, you know, developing carpal tunnel or whatever that, you know, you should wear this wrist brace or whatever they're saying.
Right.
But what, and they always look at me and they go, well, have you considered dictation? But what I found, and I tried it once, maybe 10 years ago, is that what the way I talk and the way I write are so not diametrically opposed, but so different.
No, they are different.
And so do you feel that you're writing a similar, do you feel that your writing has changed with dictation or when you clean it up? Is that when you,
I think so. And I think so. And it's okay. I think that, you know, they always ask you to read your writing out loud. Now, why is that? You know, it's because you find all the awkwardness on the written word. You can sit there in a typewriter and type out a word salad in a paragraph, right? And it seems okay with you because you got the concept and you're writing out. And then you read it and it just doesn't hold together. It doesn't make sense. If you dictate it, you can't do that. It pretty much... I'll erase over it and redo it, or I'll say, I'm sorry, that was terrible. Please put this in parentheses because I'm going to redo it. And then I go on and I don't have to. It's a placeholder, so I can go on and do the rest and I can come back and fix it later. Because sometimes you'll hit a block where you can't get through it. You just leave a placeholder and go on. And the typist will just leave a big blank there and go back and fix it. I like that because I can dictate 3,000 to 5,000 words in an hour.
Sorry, it takes me like 5 days to do that, but okay.
Yes. So if you figure your book is 50,000 words and you can do 3,000 to 5,000 an hour and you put in 4 or 5 hours, it really doesn't take that long to write a book. Now, of course, you have to edit it and let it simmer and all that stuff, but you have a lot more time to edit and simmer if you just get it on paper first.
Oh, this is so interesting because my writing process is nothing like that. But then, so I have a question for you. When you write, do you write, Okay. So, well, I'll say this because I know I write this way. So when I write, mm-hmm. I only write dialogue, and then I go back and I add blocking, and then I go back and I add description, and then I go back and I add what people were thinking. So it's four passes to get like anything out of it. And I can't do it any other way because I don't think like that. But so mm-hmm. are you writing everything at the same time? Like she yep. said, and then she walked to the kitchen, and then she thought yep. about, I don't know, the sky or whatever.
Yeah, I'm at the same time. Amy, I'm not as smart as you are. Trust me, I could not do that four pass. I would get mixed up. And what pass is this again? Am I doing dialogue or what am I doing? I couldn't do that. Honestly, I would mix myself up. I would screw it up so bad. I start with chapter one and I go all the way to the end. And that's how I do it. Now,
oh yeah, I don't do the whole book as dialogue. I would never get anything done. No. I only do 3 pages a day. So I do the pass.
Okay.
I go back and do the pass the next day. And then I go, it's a very layered process, but
you know, if you're happy with it, don't change. I mean, seriously, don't listen.
Yeah, that was the Becca Syme lesson. You know, if it works for you, don't change just because somebody else is doing something. I'm just fascinated with the idea that you can think about what people are thinking, saying, and doing at the same time, because I can't.
Yeah, it's not as bad as you think. When you look at, you know, sometimes I'll dictate something, I'll go, boy, that really stunk, you know, and then I get the paper back, and I went, wow, that's not as bad as I thought it was going to be. Mm-hmm. And at least it gives me some bones to work on.
Yes. I mean, the dialogue is the same for me. I have to have something. Otherwise it's just a blank page.
and I think it gives you quickly, because you think quicker than you can type. And that's my problem. Even though I type 200 words a minute, it's not fast enough. Okay.
I was just talking to somebody about this, she was asking, how do I pace myself since I'm thinking faster than I write? And I thought, I didn't have an answer. Yeah.
Dictation. It's dictation. I do think faster than I write. So I get it down and then it gets edited and moved around, and you have those files, and you know, and then you can read it back over and you can have them redo it. Although I usually only have them do it once, and then I redo it a lot and then send it to my editor, and she fixes the rest.
Do you eliminate the problem? Because I was just thinking about it now. When I'm typing, I type mm-hmm. probably maybe 70 words a minute, who knows? Mm-hmm. When you're typing, so since I think faster than I type, sometimes I lose the thread. So, you know, you're typing along and then you're just oh, I forgot what I said. And then I get up and I fuss around my house, fold laundry or whatever.
So that that's why I dictate.
That's so fascinating, because you solved like one of the problems, at least that I have. I don't know if other writers have this, but you're thinking along and you're typing so slowly comparatively. And then what was I going to say? And the next thing I know, I'm like, let me see what else there is to do around the house.
Okay. So sometimes in my dictation, I will say, okay, so I'm going to expand on this. Okay, typist, add this in. Okay, I'm going to expand on this, and I don't like the conversation. I need to make that twice as long, and I need to have it be more compelling. So this I'm going to redo, and I need to add this point, and this point. Thank you. And then I go on.
Wait, does he or she make those notes for you? Because what I usually do is I just have a post-it where I write it on my little post-it and then stick it on the desk, and then whenever. Yeah.
They type everything you say, including, don't put that in. Because they get paid by the word, right? So, I mean, it's okay. But it's a note. I don't care if they put parentheses around it or something. I'll find it. Mm-hmm. I know what it is. So it has freed me up, so I can sit in a pool with my cell phone, as long as I don't drop it in the water, and I can have a drink in one hand if I want, and I can float on the water and just dictate. It's wonderful. It's just wonderful. And it frees me up to spend other times doing other things. And the part, you know, I'm not thin and I'm not young, so I'm over 70, so I have to be careful about my legs, so I cannot physically sit with my knees, you know, in a sitting position for a long period of time. when I used to do that, my ankles would be really swollen. It's not good for me, Amy. So it's not good for my veins in my legs as an older writer. So this is better. And I can sit back in my chair and dictate. I can dictate on the bed. I can dictate in the car. I can dictate sitting on a bench in a park somewhere, you know?
No, this is fascinating because as age comes upon me and I spend more time at the orthopedist and other, you know, sports medicine or whatever, these lovely people, and they kindly look at you and they're like, you either need to, you know, be more ergonomic or whatever, or they're like, or things don't heal as quickly as they used to. No, one phrase don't. I hate. I'm like,
right.
I'm like, well, why does it still hurt? Well, things don't heal as quickly as they used. Oh my
gosh. Right. And you're in the sun, you know, like in Florida where I'm in the sun. So I get some tan, I get some nice vitamin D. It's healthy. It's just healthy. So I like it. And I won't go back to the other way. That's really slavery. That was the biggest problem for me. And when I started doing that, then I could write more books faster, put them out faster. Mm-hmm. Now, I may not do that forever, you know, because I may not be writing forever. I would like to just enjoy myself. we are supposed to retire eventually, but at my age, I'm just doing it for a few years and then I'll probably back off and do less per year. So,
do you think you'll miss it though? Because one of the questions that writers and I talk about is some of us, right? At least I do, is because it helps. I don't want to say it helps my sanity. I don't want to make it sound that great, but it really defines my day, organizes my thoughts. I feel compelled to tell stories. And I often, because people ask me about retirement, I often wonder, well, what would I do without it? I guess I could read more for sure. But,
you're right. I mean, Amy, you and I have never loved so many men in our lives, right? But we have in our books, right?
Right.
I mean, that's got to be satisfying to a certain amount because you fall in love with every hero, right? I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. A writer has to do that. If we don't, the reader won't. So we're doing that. We're the advance guard on that. I think that as far as missing it, I think writing a book is not like real life, and I would miss it if I didn't do it at all. So I'll probably be writing a write-up until the very end.
The one thing I wanted to ask you is, okay, so given the number of books that you have written, have you noticed in retrospect a certain theme or story that you've been telling, or something that's sort of the thing that you return to thematically in books?
I guess I would have to say it always surrounds around the healing power of love. So true love, I always say true love heals in the gardens of the heart. And since I'm a big organic gardener, that's a big thing for me. But the idea that two improbable people get together that wouldn't normally work out, but because it's true love, they can accomplish anything. Mm-hmm. And it's like the miracle of love. And I'm not tired of that theme yet. I think that when you're in love, you become the highest, best person if you're truly in love, not in lust, not trying to get somebody's money, not looking for a trophy wife or a trophy husband. You know, if you're in love, right, doesn't matter about the money, doesn't matter about the status, the looks, anything else. It's true love that you become a better person by being involved with another person in that experience. And I truly think I'm a better person after 52 years of marriage with my husband than I would have been on my own. Mm-hmm. And I'm convinced of that. So my heroes and heroines are transformed, not because of their decisions, but because of their love. And we don't have enough love or heroes in this world. So I'm doing my best to try to provide a whole bunch of them.
And we all, as readers, we all thank you. So the other thing I wanted to ask you about, so you have, I guess you'll describe it, you have the most, well, unique tattoos.
Oh,
it's hard to explain. Of, well, any writer I know. So can you explain? I don't want to try to explain it.
You mean the frog prints on my arm or the one on my back?
The arm.
The arm, yeah. Well, I thought maybe it'd be a good idea to put a frog print, a little footprint for every book I wrote. So I stopped at 27. I don't have enough room for 100. So I kind of stopped after the first group. But it's and then I used it in my Accidental Seal, my Seal Brotherhood series. All the guys have the same frog prints on their forearm just because they're a member of SEAL Team 3 and they all got the same tattoo. So it's just they look like, I guess, dots. People ask me, what is it? And it's a frog print. It's a single frog print. And then I have a frog, sort of a psychedelic frog on my back with colors. But frogs are, of course, a symbol of the SEALs. You know, they call themselves tadpoles, guppies, or, you know, tadpoles when they're just starting out, and then frogs, and then the older guys are the ones that have passed on are bone frogs. Mm-hmm. So that's where you get the term the bone frog. So you see the skeleton frog. That's a very sacred symbol. I can't put that tattoo on my body. A good tattoo artist will not do that unless you are related to someone who's passed, or you are you have a best friend, you're on a team and you've lost somebody. Those people get to have that tattoo. I can't. Right. But I do use that symbol on my books. So and my publishing company is Frog Haven Press. So I love frogs. So frog prints on my forearm, and everybody asks me that. And then I guess to tell them about my books.
But I want to thank you so, so much for talking to me today. And it was great, great talking to you. Unfortunately, I haven't seen you. I haven't seen anybody in years, which is weird.
Yeah.
You know, at the end of 2019, we were all like hanging out. And I didn't anticipate that there would be a gap. I was like, woo! I know. So that's been... It's hard.
Yeah, we'll have to fix that somehow. But eventually, you know, life is, we have a few more years. I'll be around for a few more years. We'll have to do something about that. But yeah, I look forward to another get together. I'm due for one. I really am.
And, I'm finding that I'm like, oh, I think it's time now. Especially one of the things that's been hard is that a lot of writers, and you all know who you are, left California. And so that all the people who were, whether it's a drive away or an airplane ride away, like an hour long airplane ride away, have moved. And that's been, it's been harder than I thought. I didn't, you know, it's just been harder than I thought. Not that I begrudge any of you in California, but we hear, those of us left miss you.
Do. You know, it's fun to, you know, it's fun to do things that are out of your comfort zone, and moving to another state, whether it's Florida or wherever it is a good thing. It's a healthy thing. It really is stimulating, and it gets you looking at things in a different way. It's like what they used to talk about. If you want to get a different perspective, take a different drive home. You know, we always drive the same way home.
Yes, I did it yesterday, actually. I was like, I've never been on this part of Crescent Heights Boulevard, but whatever.
And that's what it is. And so I think it helps us feel better. And I think getting outside of our comfort zone, it helps us be better creative people. And I think we spend less time thinking about what's wrong and more on what could be. And that's where I live, Amy. That's where I live. You know, what could be?
I wholeheartedly agree with you. I was writing this morning and I thought the day couldn't have started better. So I want to thank you so much, and I wish you all the delight in your dictating in a pool in Florida. I'll be here in very, very rainy, cold California, typing away with the heat that apparently I got a message is going to cost me twice as much as it used to. They sent out an alert and I was like, oh, that can't be good. But it is what it is. And
it is what it is.
I'm actually thinking a lot about what could be, what could be post-pandemic, what can be post, I don't know, inflation, recession. There's so many things that are unknown, and unknown isn't always bad.
No, we've learned a lot. We've learned a lot. And I hope we can all stay together as one human family. Everybody's made mistakes. Nobody's perfect. And we've learned a lot. And it's time to be together.
I think so.
Yeah.
I couldn't agree with you more. Well, Sharon Hamilton, I thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you.
I look forward to talking to you soon.
Yes. Thanks, Amy.
This has been A Time to Thrill with me, your host, author Amy Austin. If you enjoyed today's episode, I hope you'll share, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. It will help others find and enjoy my conversations with brilliant creators. Also, please hit the subscribe or follow button on your podcast app. In addition to hosting this podcast, I am also the author of the Nicole Long series of legal thrillers. The first two books in the Nicole Long series are now live. You can download Outcry Witness and Major Crimes to your e-reader right now. The third book in the new series, Without Consent, will be available in March 2023. In the meantime, you can pre-order it wherever you get your books. I am also the author of the Casey Court series of legal thrillers. These titles are available wherever books are sold, your local library, and also an audiobook. You can follow me on Instagram and Facebook at Legal Thriller Author. You can also find this podcast on Facebook at A Time to Thrill. Thanks for listening, and I'll be back with you soon with more great conversations.